Good morning. It's 8:06 on this Monday. You're listening to the KBCW Local News Hour. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher today. Traffic across the region largely looks pretty clear for any commuters, visitors, other drivers out there. There's some slight slowdowns on I-80 just before that exit towards Heber if you're heading eastbound from Park City to Heber. Other than that, no major delays to report. I'll keep you posted if anything changes on the traffic front. As far as weather, it's a nice cool morning here in Park City, clear skies and 58 degrees. With details about today's weather is Cedric Haynes from ABC4 Meteorology.
Happy Monday, Utah. It's time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch Pack as we go throughout your Monday, the beginning of a holiday week across the state. We're looking at mostly sunny to partly sunny skies as we get into your Monday afternoon. Our friends in Park City will be looking at those high temperatures climbing into the lower 80s as we go throughout this afternoon. The Heber Valley, partly cloudy skies and temperatures climbing into the mid to upper 80s for highs. Along with those partly cloudy skies, there will be a chance of a couple of isolated downpours developing as we go throughout the afternoon. The key word is very isolated. Though, as most of us will likely stay dry. Still, keep an eye to the sky in case you see one of those pop-up storms. Otherwise, as we go into your Tuesday, look for mostly sunny skies. We'll see drier air working its way back into the area. High temperatures will remain in the low 80s for us in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures into the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. Moving into your Wednesday, look for sunshine and temperatures on the warm side as we're in the low to mid 80s for Park City, with high temperatures right around 90 degrees coming up for us in the Heber Valley. We'll call it mostly sunny to partly sunny skies as we get into your Thursday, which of course happens to be Pioneer Day. Right now it's looking primarily dry with high temperatures into the low 80s in Park City. We're looking at high temperatures climbing into the upper 80s to near 90 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we wrap up the work week, lots of sunshine is expected on your Friday. For Park City, we'll see high temperatures in the mid 80s for highs, and for the Heber Valley, high temperatures will climb into the lower 90s. So heating up as we move into the upcoming weekend. Your Saturday and Sunday will feature mostly sunny to partly sunny skies, and we're looking at dry conditions likely for both Park City and in the Heber Valley. High temperatures in Park City will climb into the mid to upper 80s over the weekend, with high temperatures in the Heber Valley climbing into the lower 90s across the area. Again, mainly dry conditions are expected, but look for another warming trend heading into the weekend. But of course, today, partly sunny skies with that slight chance of an isolated shower or storm possible. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
It's coming up on 8:09. You're listening to KBCW's Local News Hour. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. Coming up, we have a full morning of interviews. We'll start the hour with the executive director of the Park City Soccer Club, Shelly Gilwald, along with the Park City Extreme Cup tournament director, Cora Redden. They have details on the tournament, which is happening July 24th through the 26th here in the Wasatch Back. Then we have Youth Sports Alliance executive director, Emily Fisher, who will join the show to give an update on youth sports programs. Snyderville Basin Recreation Director Dana Jones is also on air this morning. She'll share updates on what's going on at Basin Rec. Basin Recreation is a financial supporter of this station. Finally, to close the hour, KBCW General Manager Julianna Allely and Development Director Sarah Irvin will join us in the studio to talk a little bit about funding for public media and what's happened since Congress voted to rescind funding allocated to NPR stations across the country. But first, some local news. Well, a new report on the state of Utah's housing says Summit County's median sale price dipped slightly last year, but it's still the highest in the state. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more.
Data analysis from the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah shows the median sale price of homes in Summit County was $1.64 million last year. The median Wasatch County home went for nearly $993,000 in 2024. For Summit County, that's a marginal decrease from 2023 and a 7.7 increase for Wasatch. The numbers are from the Gardner Institute's State of the State's Housing Market report released July 8th. Senior research fellow Dehan Eskick says overall it's a glass half full or glass half empty data, depending on how you look at it.
Obviously, we've gotten more expensive, more unaffordable. When we compare to last year, you know, housing prices, rents have kind of stagnated. We got a little bit of an income bump. So we've made some progress, right? So, you know, things have gotten slightly better, but, you know, tell that to the average person looking to buy a house and they're going to laugh in your face probably.
Grand and Rich counties joined Summit as the three resort and recreation locales that saw decreases in the median price of homes. Prices in Grand County, home to Moab, decreased almost 14%. Gardner's statisticians also looked at housing prices compared to incomes across Utah to measure which counties are the most and least affordable. The report says Weber, Davis, and Utah counties are, quote, seriously unaffordable, and Washington and Salt Lake counties are severely unaffordable. That analysis was not included for the Wasatch Back, but Eskick told KPCW Summit County is twice as unaffordable as Washington or Salt Lake. Home prices, he says, are usually tied to employment trends, but the Wasatch Back is a complete outlier.
With second homes, short-term rentals, the recreational aspect, right? There's a lot of competition that's more insulated sort of from the day-to-day economics of up and down job growth.
The Institute used U.S. Census Bureau, American Community Survey, and UtahRealEstate.com data for its analysis. A copy of the report is at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And about 500 people from the Wasatch Back and beyond watched as a helicopter installed lift towers on new terrain at Deer Valley's East Village Saturday. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
Hundreds of people attended Deer Valley's Future in Flight event. It was a chance to see crews installing lift towers on new terrain on the East Village side of the resort in Wasatch County. Visitors started at Snow Park Lodge and took the Silver Lake Express and Sterling Express chairlifts to the top of Bald Mountain. At the peak, visitors lounged in seating areas to watch the construction team in action. Kids under 12 rode free with their parents and each received a yellow hard hat and neon vest, including Parkite Lindsay Wolford's 5 and 2-year-old daughters.
They love them. They got vests, they got little hard hats. It was cute. It was super cool to see them building the lifts and the helicopters going in and out.
Visitors heard the heavy lift Chinook helicopter before they saw it. They crowded onto the windy overlook to watch as its red and white striped tandem rotors flew in lift tower pieces for the Pinion Express chairlift and East Village gondola. Deer Valley President Todd Bennett said the tower designs vary depending on a few factors.
They design the specific pieces that are going to be installed based on the elevation at which they're going to be installed and the type of equipment that is going to be flying them. So today was kind of the heavy load, the big items, and that's why we've got the Chinook running for the upper sections of the gondola.
Once completed, the 10-passenger East Village Express gondola will have 40 towers, 142 cabins, 31,000 feet of haul rope, and it will take 14 and a half minutes to get to the top. After enjoying the view and helicopter lift installation, visitors headed back to the Silver Lake Lawn for yard games, food, and live music from Mountain Town. Including the gondola, Bennett said 7 lifts and 80 trails in the East Village area are under construction this summer. They'll all open for the 2025-26 ski season, adding to the 3 lifts and 20 trails that opened last season. Bennett said over half of the nearly 50 miles of snowmaking pipe has been installed so far. He said it's one of the most advanced snowmaking systems in the world. Every snow gun will be Ethernet connected, and Bennett said the operations team can operate them remotely from their phones and computers.
When we get our cold temperatures, we've got to go, and that gives us the ability to turn those guns on quickly, get them pointed in the right direction, and start making snow so that we can get as many trails as possible open for the Christmas holiday, and then make sure that we have the right snow all the way into April.
When all the expanded terrain is open, Deer Valley will have more than doubled in size, totaling more than 5,700 acres of skiable terrain. Deer Valley Resort is a financial supporter of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
It is 8:15. You're listening to KPCW's Local News Hour. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. Well, in studio with us are Cora Redden, the tournament director for the Park City Extreme Cup, and Shelley Gilwald, who heads the Park City Soccer Club. Ladies, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks, Grace.
Thanks so much for having us.
I would love to start out with, we've got literally thousands of people coming to the Wasatch Back starting this Thursday. Tell us a little bit about who's on the way, from players, where they're from, what ages you have represented, things like that.
We have players from 8 to 18 coming to the Wasatch Back from all over, Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, and Wyoming, along with the Wasatch Front, Southern Utah, Northern Utah,
Nice. And how many teams do we have in total on the way?
We have 453 teams, estimated a little bit over 8,000 players.
Oh my goodness. And about 800 soccer games, over 800 soccer games.
Over 800 soccer games, yeah.
How do you coordinate all that? That just sounds like a massive event to try and pull together.
It's a year-round event. You know, sometimes busier than others, but it never stops.
Mm-hmm. So it starts Thursday. Tell me a little bit about what the tournament format is like. How do the teams work?
Thursday and Friday are pool play games. Friday evening and Saturday, semifinals and finals. And we've got some of the highest competition teams from all over headed to Park City.
That's pretty cool. I see that part of it is round robin play for a layperson. Could you explain what that is?
It's just a scheduled game where they know exactly who they're playing in the round robin part, and then semifinals and finals, unknown.
Gotcha.
The tournament is, I believe, Cora, this year, 64 brackets.
Yeah, 64.
So
brackets.
Our different ages, the girls and the boys, all through the different age groups, are divided into these different brackets. So within that, they'll have, three games that they'll play, and then that will determine their ranking, and then whether they go on to semifinals or finals from there. So every team is guaranteed at least three games.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Some playing as many as five.
Gotcha. And I guess I'm curious, what's the benefit of having so much soccer packed into such a short amount of time?
We turn away teams every year. So it's all about fitting as many soccer teams as we can in because we want them to keep coming back.
Mm-hmm. Is part of this, I guess it depends on the ages a little bit, but is part of this to try and, you know, get involved with college recruiters maybe for some of the older players?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I mean playing the same teams that you've lost to in the past, a lot of teams come back for redemption.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite part about the 3 days?
Just seeing all the kids on the soccer fields, you know, the way that it's laid out, and we're spread out all over the Wasatch Back. It's not a lot of traffic at the actual venue like it is at some other complexes, and people love that. People love, you know, just being in the mountains, the cooler weather. You know, it's beautiful.
The tournament tagline is come for the soccer, stay for the vacation. And so we really do try and take advantage of, you know, the Park City summer, how gorgeous it is, and encourage people to come up.
Definitely. Cora, you mentioned that there's venues kind of all over the Wasatch Back. Could you tell me a little bit more about where people will be playing?
They'll be at Ecker Hill, Matt Noop, Willow Creek, Park City High School, North 40 Fields, Quinn Sports Complex, Trailside Park,
City
Loomis,
Park,
Loomis and- Park, City Park, which is a special occasion. We're almost never at City Park, but we have lots of local teams scheduled to play at City Park just for the excitement of it.
Then we're also in Oakley. Mm-hmm. And three venues over in Heber. Mm-hmm. I think back in 2014, we actually had to start going over to Wasatch County a little bit because we just didn't have the room for the teams.
Oh, wow. It's grown that much.
Yep.
That's incredible. So can anybody watch the games?
Yes. Spectators are more than welcome at any of the fields, and games are going pretty much from 8 until at least 8 every day.
Wow. It'll be a jam-packed weekend. Do you sell tickets for the games, or can you just walk up?
No, spectators are free.
Okay. I guess that kind of leads to my next question. I'm not sure which of you would like to answer it first, but I know scholarships are part of what you do. How do you raise the money for those scholarships, and what are they for?
So the Park City Soccer Club has a philosophy that we're not going to turn away any child who's qualified, who makes a team. Mm-hmm. And we're going to raise those funds. This past year, we gave away over $170,000 in need-based financial aid to kids, enabling them to play. That covered, I believe, 117 players last year. This year, we're already at 126 mm-hmm. kids needing financial aid. And so the tournament has raised well over a million, actually almost 1.2 million prior to this summer for the club's financial aid program since 2005. It's not all of it. We also use grants and Live PC, Give PC, but what the work that Cora and her team do are the foundation of our financial aid program, and that's combination of entry fees, some grants. The Chamber Bureau is a big sponsor this year, and then other sponsors help raise those funds so that we can keep kids from our community playing soccer.
Good to know. And Shelley, could I just ask you a little bit more about that? You know, people might think, oh, you just show up to the field with some, you know, running shoes on. What are the hidden expenses that people might not think about to get into sports like this?
Oh, goodness. Well, again, the program fees. Park City Soccer Club hires all licensed professional coaches. So our budget's a little bit different than, say, a rec program that uses a parent who just volunteers their time. Our club right now is just under 600 kids, about 38 teams. And so there are the program fees. Of course, there are the uniform fees, which we cover for our financial aid kids. But the other thing is tournament play, and I think you were asking a little bit about this earlier. Tournament play is an important part of competitive soccer experience. Mm-hmm. Getting out there, playing different teams, but also the travel and the team bonding, the memories that the kids make, but also technically being able to play back-to-back games, executing on different tactics the kids have been learning. So tournaments are an important part of our club, and just like we've got all these teams traveling here for Cora's event, our kids travel Arizona, Las Vegas, Colorado, Idaho, Southern Utah, and it's costly. So one of the things we commit to our financial aid players is to assist with that travel. They're part of the team. We want them to be able to go have the same experiences, contribute the same as they would at a home game. This past year, we spent over $43,000 assisting our kids going to tournaments and having that be part of their developmental process.
Gotcha. Well, thank you for explaining that.
Yeah.
How do kids apply, or how do families apply?
Park City Soccer Club, from 8 years old and older, is a tryout-based program. Our tryouts are held in May. However, we really have a rolling engagement with kids. We have kids moving to the summer, to the community all summer. And if we have room, they'll just come out and train for a couple weeks with a team and with a coach, and we'll evaluate if it's a good fit and add them if it is. For our kids that are seven and under, well, I should say 5 through 7, it's a program called the Foundations Program. It's 4 months, summer through late fall, starts again in February through spring, and that's just, if we have room, we'll add kids. And that's truly the foundation. They learn the basic skills under Coach Mark Caligari. Hopefully they're learning a deep passion for the game. So far, so good with that. He's incredible.
Awesome. And Cora, outside of the soccer games that are happening this weekend, obviously it's a lot of tourists coming to town, a lot of visitors. Could you speak at all to some of the tourism impacts on Park City, or some of the even traffic impacts of having so many visitors?
Yeah, there definitely are traffic impacts. And we just do our best to use great signage and lots of signage, pre-tournament communications to teams, just letting them know where they need to be, where they shouldn't be, just trying to keep the community impact as low as possible.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that is unique to our event is we're not on Main Street, so we don't impact the historic district. Mm-hmm. And again, Cora has the tournament so spread out. It's on 41 fields at
13 venues.
Again, so families are able to go straight out to Oakley or straight to Ecker Hill. So it sounds overwhelming, but it's really pretty well managed. I think it's Somewhere around a quarter of the games are in the 84060 zip code. Mm-hmm. So when you think about the size and the scope of the tournament, it's really not impactful to any one area. Of course, you know, Kimball Junction, the, you know, 8040 and 8224, you know, exits are impacted. Grocery stores, fast food. So the local community should probably plan ahead with their trips to the grocery store or maybe the gas station. But in terms of the traffic, CORE has it really, really well spread out around the Wasatch back. So it's not as scary as it sounds.
Fair enough.
And I mean, it's some of the top 5 days for restaurants in the community of the year.
Wow. Yeah. And it sounds like maybe some of the top 5 days for soccer as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Is there anything else you would like to add about this year's Extreme Cup?
You know, if folks are interested in finding out the schedule or what age groups are playing where, the website is parkcityextremecup.com, and there's a tab that says schedule right at the top, and people can go in and figure that out. But again, we're at most of the fields around Park City. We're impacted this year with Dozier and Treasure construction, that hence the city council was kind enough to let us be at City Park this year. But again, then Heber, Wasatch High School, J.R. Smith and the Rocky Mountain Middle School, and then the Oakley Rodeo Grounds is actually pretty exciting with six fields going at once out there.
Awesome. Well, I hope the competition goes really smoothly.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us, Grace.
Yeah.
Thank you. We've
been speaking with Shelley Gilwald and Cora Redden. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. It's 8:29. You're listening to the Local News Hour from KPCW. I'm Grace Dorfler. Well, here in the studio with us, we have Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher. Emily, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Well, there's a lot going on, as always. Let's get started by talking a little bit about scholarships. It sounds like the application period is open now for people to apply for some winter sports program scholarships.
Yeah, so at the Youth Sports Alliance, we have two different scholarships. So our Stein Erickson Dare to Dream scholarships are for athletes that are in our 7-member clubs. And so athletes in those clubs can apply for a scholarship. The scholarship window is from August 1st to August 31st, but I believe the scholarship is actually open now. And those scholarships are all need-based, so it's a little bit more of an in-depth scholarship process, but they're need-based for athletes in those 7 clubs, and this is for their annual cost of programming. So they can apply for a full year, outline their expenses, and then apply for that scholarship, and we award those in the fall.
Wonderful. And how many scholarships are you typically able to award in a year?
So it's anywhere, depending on the number who apply and the need, it's anywhere probably from 90 to 110 scholarships. Last year, I believe we gave out $185,000 to the community. And since we started our scholarship program, we have given out $1.3 million in assistance from that Stein Erickson Endowment. So really a game changer to help those athletes in those 7-member clubs.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about kind of the breakdown of who's receiving these scholarships? For example, are they more popular among maybe high school kids who are getting more serious in their sports, or is it really spread out?
It's really spread out, and it depends. Again, it's really based on need. So athletes demonstrating they really need this scholarship in order to participate. So we have athletes as young as 8 and then all the way up to 21 is sort of when the scholarship ends, is for athletes in that age range. But it's really just for families that are facing challenges, keeping their children in sport. We want to make sure that they can all participate if they choose.
Mm-hmm. And what's required to apply?
So our scholarship is online. It's just ysausa.org, and then you can negotiate to the scholarship page. There's an application. There's some financial information that families fill out. And then we do ask that the athlete submits a letter just talking about their sport and what it means to them.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of a personal statement.
Yeah. Just to give us sort of a more of an idea of what the sport means to them and why it's important for them to participate.
Yeah, I'm sure it's also meaningful to kind of get a sense of the person that you're giving it to, the personality as well.
Yeah, for sure. Our scholarship committee reviews all of the scholarships, and I can tell you there's usually tears every year. A lot of these stories are very compelling. I think sometimes in the community, people don't realize the need that's out there and that kids need financial assistance to participate in sport. But over 50% of our applicants are typically on the free and reduced lunch program, which means for a family of four, they're making less than $45,000 a year. So there is need in the community for students to participate in those seven member clubs.
Yeah. What teams do you partner with?
So we have seven partner clubs. Figure Skating Club of Park City, Park City Ice Miners, Park City Speed Skating Club, Park City Ski and Snowboard, Utah Olympic Park, Bobsled and Skeleton, Wasatch Freestyle, and Wasatch Luge Club.
Wonderful. It looks like the deadline is coming up at the end of August for kids to apply or families to apply. Go ahead.
I was going to say August 31st is an important deadline. But if you know you are going to apply, the sooner you apply, the easier it makes us for us to process all of those scholarships and make sure that we have all the pieces that we need to evaluate those. And again, it's for your annual fees. So it's for fall, winter, spring, and next summer. So it's that annual year, sort of what you think it's going to cost for you to participate.
I see. And when can students expect to hear back?
So typically, it takes us a little while to, as I said, gather all the pieces and parts, and our scholarship committee gets together and meets, and then typically the athletes and families will hear back in early October. All of the clubs that we work with, we've sort of had these same timelines, same deadlines, so they will work with families. If they know they want to sign up for a program but haven't heard back yet, they're typically lenient with figuring out payment plans and things like that.
Okay. That's a relatively quick turnaround for your review team.
Yeah, we try.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add about this particular scholarship program?
It's really heartwarming, and it's a great way to make sure that all the students and athletes out there that want to participate can, if you've tried a sport through our after-school programs and now want to join a club but are unsure about your family's ability to pay, please apply, because we want to make sure that everybody can participate that wants to.
Wonderful. Let's talk a little bit about after-school programs.
You have
a lot going on for kids in after-school care.
Yeah, so our after-school programs for our elementary schools, it's Get Out and Play, and for our middle schools, it's called Activate. Those are all run on early release days for the most part. Registration will open for the first sessions in mid-August. Programs will start a little bit earlier this year, just after Labor Day. And we have a ton planned for this year. Last year, our after-school programs grew by 25%. So we had over 3,200 kids in 26 local schools. So we are excited for even more programs this year. Coming up this fall, mountain biking, sailing, triathlon, basketball, rise boxing, sim sports, acting, Woodward multi-sport. We have the Fit Stop in Heber with the Ninja Course. Golf skills, roller skiing, skateboarding, zip lining, dog sledding, all different things. So if you're looking for something for your student to do on those early release days, check out our website. As I said, mid-August is when registration will open for those programs.
Wow, that is so many activity options, truly something for everybody.
Yeah, we're just truly trying to introduce kids. All of our programs are just bite-sized. As a parent, I appreciate you're not signing your kid up for a whole year for something that you don't know if they really love yet. So they can come just try lots of different things, see what they're passionate about, and then we can point them in that direction. So all of our information is at ysausa.org.
What's the cost of the program?
So all of them have different costs depending on basically the cost to us. But we, for our after-school programs, we actually also have scholarships. So we offer two levels of scholarships. So students that are eligible for the free and reduced lunch just pay a small commitment fee to participate. And then families making up to $120,000 a year can also request a scholarship. It's an easy, straightforward application. They get a discount code and they pay half of the registration fees. They apply once for that code and can use it for the rest of the year.
Okay. You mentioned that, you know, the registration opens in mid-August. Is there a deadline to register?
Yeah, there is, and it's slightly different for all the programs. It kind of depends when they start, but we do have to close registration in order to get all of the waivers done, all of the rosters to our partners who are coaching those programs. So you just have to check the website to see the different timelines on those programs.
Okay, understood. And it's open to students across the Wasatch Back, correct?
Yeah, Summit and Wasatch counties. We are now in Park City School District, South Summit, North Summit, and also Wasatch, but also open to homeschool students across the Wasatch Back as well.
Great to know. And finally, let's spend a couple of minutes talking about your upcoming event in October, the Jan's Winter Welcome. What's the event?
Yeah, so Jan's Winter Welcome, we're ramping up again this year. It's our annual Black Tie fundraiser. This is the 45th annual Jan's Winter Welcome. So shout out to Jan's. Thank you so much for your title sponsorship. They have been an incredible partner over the years. It is Saturday, October 25th, so easy to remember, 10-25-25. It's at Stein Erickson Lodge, and we're excited to partner with our seven winter sport clubs again this year. It's one event, but it benefits eight organizations. So we come together to help our partner teams raise money during that event as well.
Okay, and what's included in the night?
So the night is super fun. As I said, just partnering with Stein Erickson Lodge. They've been an incredible partner, always incredible food, drink, and setting. So we have a silent auction, we have dinner, we have dancing, we have a live auction, and a paddle raise. And one exciting part two is we have an opportunity drawing. So this year, again, huge shout out to Intermountain Health. They have sponsored our opportunity drawing package. This year, it's a trip to the HF Bar Ranch in Wyoming. It's a four-night stay for four people. So four nights for four guests, including cabins, meals, horseback riding, swimming, hiking, kids programs, and then it also comes with a $5,000 credit, and you can use that for guided fly fishing, they have trap shooting, travel to the ranch, or additional nights if that's something that you want to add on to your package. So the tickets are just $50, and what's really neat through our sponsorship with Intermountain Health, that $50 goes back to whatever club that you would like to support or the Youth Sports Alliance. So if you, when you buy your tickets online, YSAUSA.org, you can indicate a club that you want to support and an athlete that you'd like to support. So all the athletes in the seven clubs sort of compete to see who can sell the most tickets, and then that money goes back to that club at 100%.
Awesome. Well, Emily, it sounds like there's a lot going on, as always, at Youth Sports Alliance. Anything else you'd like to add this morning?
No, just thank you again to the community for supporting our scholarship fund. Last year, Jan's Winter Welcome, we helped the teams raise almost $350,000 through the auction items and the opportunity drawing, and then another $264,000 for those need-based scholarships through the Stein Erickson Endowment. So thank you, and I hope we can break more records this year.
Great. We've been speaking with YSA Executive Director Emily Fisher. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to KPCW's Local News Hour. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. It's 8:41, and in the studio with us is Snyderville Basin Recreation Director Dana Jones. Dana, good morning.
Good morning, Grace. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Well, lots going on at the Fieldhouse and elsewhere in Basin Rec. Let's start with the renovations to the Fieldhouse. What's planned for the building?
So, you know, that's going to be a fairly big project for folks that visit the field house frequently. We're redoing the front entrance way where the front desk is going to be. We're redoing the locker rooms and the shower areas. And we're creating an alternative entry to the pool. So you don't actually have to walk through the locker rooms to get to the pool. You can actually walk through a doorway that's going to be coming off where the courts are. So that our contractors is standing by, and we're just waiting for our final permits from the county, and then we're going to be starting work on that. So if you visit the field house, you're going to be seeing a little bit of disruptions, you know, over the next few months. We're doing the best we can to minimize that, but it is going to be a little bit like a construction zone for a little while.
Fair enough. How do you decide when facilities need an update?
You know, the field house has been there for a number of years, and this one was precipitated by a number of things. One of them is, you know, we just determined that it's a better flow. We have so many more people that go in and out of the field house now than we did, you know, even, you know, 5 years ago, 3 years ago. So we needed better flow coming in the front doors, and, you know, the front desk people better able to direct people places. The other thing is some of the legislation that's been recently passed in the state having to do with privacy laws. Mm-hmm. So that kind of precipitated the ability for people to get to the pool without having to walk through the locker rooms. And a lot of that is, I mean, if you're a parent and you have young children, mm-hmm. you know, do you take them through the men's locker room? Do you take mm-hmm. them through the women's locker room? Do you kind of send them by themselves to go through that door and come out the door on the other side and hope they do kind of thing? So this is going to make it a lot nicer for families.
Okay. You mentioned it'll be a construction zone for a little while. What kind of timeline do you have in mind?
You know, it shouldn't be more than a couple months. Mm-hmm. So we hope that by the time the winter hits, which is really the busiest time at the field house, is the winter when people aren't outside and they want to be working out inside. Although it does seem like it's busy year round now with our summer camps being there and all the different programs that we offer. But we are hopeful that by, say, the, you know, November, December time frame, it's going to be all wrapped up and people will be able to enjoy it for the winter.
Gotcha. And how will facilities access be affected? Will some of the locker rooms be closed at times, or?
Yes. Okay. There will be a period of time when parts of the locker room are closed. We'll have other restrooms that you can use. Mm-hmm. There will be probably a couple weeks when we will not have showers available. Mm-hmm. So that'll be a little tricky for those like myself who uses the swimming pool. Mm-hmm. You'll have to get out and go shower either at home or somewhere else. So.
Gotcha. And do you have an estimated cost for the project?
Ooh, that is a good question, and I don't have the numbers right off the top of my head.
Okay, fair enough. Well, that's exciting stuff for the field house. Let's talk about events going on at the field house and elsewhere on Bakes and Rec facilities. I've seen a lot of summer campers. What other events do you have going on this summer?
You know, something that you just talked to folks about earlier in the news broadcast is the Extreme Cup is coming up. That is pretty much all of our fields are hosting those tournaments. And we just want to remind people, you know, please pay attention to signage. Please park where you're supposed to park. And because we don't want to impact our local neighborhoods and our local residents negatively. So our ranger team's going to be out, and our special event team's going to be out making sure that people are behaving well and parking where they're supposed to park. And we have good turnovers in the parking lots and stuff like that. So Extreme Cup is a big one. It's pretty much our biggest outside event that we have every year. We do have our own events. Tomorrow there's going to be the Bike and Botany event, mm-hmm. which is held in conjunction with Swanner, mm-hmm. and we're looking forward to that one. We have several weed pulls, volunteer trail work days. On August 1st, we have the movie and camp out in the park. Mm-hmm. So that's really geared toward our local residents. It's a free event. We would like you to register for it so we know how many people are coming. So just come out and camp out overnight, you know, pitch your tents and watch a movie in the park with your kids. And we also, on August 2nd, we have a very popular downhill and grill event. So come on out to the bike park on August 2nd. We're going to be serving free hamburgers, hot dogs, chips. You know, we love to talk to people using the bike park and some of our local residents and neighbors. So lots going on in the Basin Parks.
As always, you mentioned a minute ago, rangers making sure people are on good behavior. I would love to talk a little bit about the Willow Creek Pond, because it sounds like maybe we've had some problems there recently.
Oh, you're jumping ahead. So, you know, and this is just a reminder that the Willow Creek Pond is primarily an irrigation pond. That mm-hmm. pond is there. It holds water so that we can water the fields, so mm-hmm. that we can play soccer on the fields and have, you know, events on the fields. It does have secondary uses. In the wintertime, we use it as an ice rink, and people go out there and play hockey. In the summertime, we like to use it as a place for dogs to go and swim. There are reasons that we will close it. In the wintertime, if the ice is too thin and it's dangerous, we close the pond. If there's any algae blooms, we'll close the pond. Unfortunately, at this time, we had to close the pond due to people's behavior. I mean, we were actually having people almost get in fights out there about dogs and their people's behavior and dogs' behavior and dogs' lack of recall. And so we did close the pond due to that. Mm-hmm. We're kind of hoping that people will rally around that, but we still have had some vandalism, people taking the gates off the hinges to get in and stealing the closure signs. So we really do need people to kind of rally around this and behave correctly, and we'll hopefully get that pond open soon.
Oh, wow. Even trying to break in even after you've announced it's closed?
Yes.
Wow. Does that mean it'll stay closed for the foreseeable future?
You know, we're evaluating every week to determine what's going to be the best way to do it. We're hopeful that it'll be open soon, but we really need to be able to rely on people and positive behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so being able to recall your dog, not harassing wildlife, not vandalizing, you know, gates and signs and properties. And then we're happy to offer that secondary use of the pond as a dog pond.
Yeah, treat the facilities well.
There we go.
Yeah. Elsewhere, in terms of your open space, it sounds like there's going to be some trail construction happening over by Ecker Hill. Could you share a little bit about the High Ute trail plans?
So our contractor has mobilized, and it has started work on some of the trails in that area. It's kind of funny that just when he came in to start that work, Ecker is doing a big paving project, and so we're kind of doing the dance and getting everything going. But we did get, last week, we did get County Council to sign off on the easement agreements between Basin Recreation, High Ute, Utah Open Lands, and Pine Brook Association. Mm-hmm. So we have all our easements. We're ready to go, and that trail is currently in the process of being built. It is it's not an easy one. If you've seen the terrain out there, and I actually helped hike and flag the trail, it was rough going. So it's not going to be built overnight, and we anticipate that it's going to take this season and next season. So we're hopeful that it will be open sometime middle to the end of next season.
Okay, that's exciting stuff. And then just, we're almost out of time here, but I'd love to hear a little update on the search for a new director for Basin Rec.
So we advertised the position. We've got 70 plus applications.
Wow.
So there is a hiring committee. It is primarily the board that is making that selection. They select the top candidate, and then that is referred to County Council for final approval. And one of the County Council members is going to be sitting on the final interviews. We anticipate two rounds of interviews of the top candidates, and I am hopefully we'll be able to get the top candidate to our board and County Council in September, October.
Okay.
And then get that person in, and it'll be interesting because it'll be right in the middle of budget season. We're working on next year's budget, so I'm I want to set the next person up for success, mm-hmm. because I think that's really important to come into an organization where, you know, you can kind of slide in without having to worry about a lot of issues at the beginning. It's a great job. The management team is awesome. The staff at Basin is great. So just looking for somebody that really can relate with the managers and the staff and the community and the council and the board. And so that's going to be really fun.
It's a multifaceted job. So this person would step into your shoes in 2026, starting in January or sooner?
I'm actually hoping October-ish.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Crossing my fingers for sometime in October.
Gotcha. Well, we'll look forward to hearing more updates on that front.
My next time here might be my last time here.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning. Is there anything else you want to add today?
Nope. Just looking forward to the rest of the summer.
Wonderful. We've been talking with Basin Recreation Director Dana Jones. Dana, thank you. It's 8:53. You're listening to KPCW's Local News Hour. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on this Monday morning. In the studio with me are KPCW's General Manager Juliana Alley and Development Director Sarah Irvin. They're here to talk about recent news out of Washington that the Congress voted to rescind funding from public media. Juliana, to start, could you just give us a recap of what's been going on?
Sure. Good morning, Grace. Thanks so much for having us. It's been a long spring and a long summer. There's been a lot of back and forth between the White House to Congress, asking them to rescind funding for public media. And it culminated last Friday with a final vote in the House. The House had approved that rescission a couple weeks ago. Then the Senate had to weigh in on it. The Senate, because they amended it, it had to go back to the House for one final vote, which happened last Friday evening. And they did do what the White House was looking for them to do, which was rescind funding for public media as well as for foreign aid. Public media was combined into about $10 million package of rescission of funding, and $1.1 billion of that was for public media.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about that word rescission. Mm-hmm. This whole situation is unusual, but what's especially unusual is this is previously allocated funding. Could you just explain that briefly?
Yeah, for sure. So a year ago, every summer, Sarah, why don't you take that one? Because you know a little bit more in depth about the transactions and how White House and Congress functions.
So I think it's important for listeners to understand that public media funding at the federal level flows through an independent agency. It's really a nonprofit organization called the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I think there's a misconception out there that federal funding goes directly to NPR and PBS and that somehow the money flows from those entities down to small stations like us. That is absolutely not true. And in fact, it flows the other direction. The money that Congress annually has appropriated every year since 1967 goes to an entity called the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is an independent nonprofit organization that receives a federal appropriation in the rough amount lately of about $535 million per year. CPB takes that money and distributes it to the network of public radio and public television stations nationwide. There's about 1,500 stations that receive CPB funding in the form of direct grants, community service grants. KPCW is one of those organizations that receives an annual grant from CPB. And then there is a massive amount of what CPB does, which is maintaining national infrastructure and managing national infrastructure for public broadcasting, for emergency alerts, for the public radio satellite system. And this is in partnership with national organizations like NPR, but it's not just NPR, it's APM, it's other national public media providers. Mm-hmm. But I do think that this issue over the last, 6 months to several years has sort of become a bit of a political battle around defunding NPR for perceived bias at the national level. But I think what's really important for our listeners to understand is that the impact is really going to be felt here at the local level. Mm-hmm. We at KPCW receive roughly $264,000 annually currently from that CPB community service grant program. That's what we were approved to receive when Juliana mentioned that, you know, this was money that Congress had already voted on. So because of political concerns, CPB is always forward funded by 2 years. So Congress votes to approve that, $535 million a year for CPB. They approved in 2025, they approved that money for 2026 and 2027. Mm-hmm. So KPCW already knew we were to receive $264,000 as our community service grant starting in FY26, which for us starts September 1st. Mm-hmm. For the federal government, those checks typically go out in October. Mm-hmm. So that's a loss of $264,000 in a straight grant that we were set to receive this fall and again next fall. And so the impact is going to be felt, like I said, very directly, very locally, and then that broader impact about the infrastructure nationally is something that we are still...
figuring that out. We're getting our arms around that. CPB also manages the music licensing for public media stations. Mm-hmm. So we've got some homework to do there. We've got a little bit more time with that one because my understanding is that those music licenses have been negotiated and paid through the end of this calendar year. But it's high on the list because one thing we love here at KPCW is our music and obviously the news and information that we could provide the community.
What else can you tell us about what this funding cut will mean for KPCW programming for listeners out there?
Sure. So ironically, the Finance Committee and I are meeting tomorrow afternoon. It's budget season, as Sarah mentioned. Our fiscal year ends on August 31st, and we turn the page for September 1st. And so we've got to sharpen our pencils and really think about the programming that we provide for the community. You know, how will it look? Does it need to look a little bit different? Do we need to rethink some of our original programming, our community outreach? Mm-hmm. Our FCC license is a non-commercial license, and that dictates how we present things on air, what we can say, what we can't say, what our guests can say. But our digital offerings, the app, our website, and of course the local that everyone hopefully is receiving in their inbox Monday through Friday and on Sundays, those things, we can make them look a little bit different. We can rethink how underwriters are presented in our digital offerings to give them more opportunities to get their message out and hopefully support KPCW.
Well, certainly more to come on that front. In about 20 seconds, Sarah, how can listeners support this station?
So, you know, I want to acknowledge that we do have a fair number of supporters in the community who are not unhappy to see federal money no longer flowing to public media stations. They think that it should not be taxpayer supported, but they do strongly support KPCW or the equivalent in their local communities. So I'd say, you know, to folks who are concerned, please, we hope you'll step up with additional support if you value the local news you receive, the traffic updates, all of the programming that KPCW provides. Certainly, we are looking for increased local support, increased underwriter support, and then we are going to be speaking, of course, with our fellow public media partners throughout the state of Utah to see what the state might step up with as well.
Okay. Juliana Allely and Sarah Irvin, thank you so much.
Thank you.